Right.
We're now recording.
All right. Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call this
this call is now being recorded.
2022 meeting of the Legislation and Rules Committee to order. Can I have a roll call, please?
Mr. Marley?
Here.
Mr. Brady?
Here.
Mr. Bartlett?
Here.
Mr. Stanley?
Here.
Dr. Angel? Mr. Fondren?
Here.
Mr. Leeds?
Here.
Hey, we have a quorum.
Wonderful. Well, welcome, everyone. Call to the public. Members of the public may address the committee during this call to the public for no more than 3 minutes pursuant to ARS 38-431.01H. The committee members are not allowed to discuss or take legal action on matters raised during an open call to the public unless the matters are properly noticed for discussion and legal action. However, members may ask staff to review a matter or may ask that the matter be placed on a future agenda. Is there anyone who wishes to appear before the committee at this time?
Mr. Murray, there's no one physically here requesting that, and no one has contacted staff regarding the wish to do so.
Then we will close that section, thank you, and move on to adoption of minutes. Approve, modify, or reject the September 20th, 2021 L&R committee minutes. Do I have a motion?
Motion to approve, Mr. Fondren.
And do I have a second?
I'll second.
And any discussion? And who seconded? We need to identify.
Leroy.
Okay, Leroy, thank you. Sorry, I can't see anybody. So, if there's no discussion or corrections to be made, all those in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed?
For the record,
yes.
Hey, for the record, yes. Dr. Angel has just joined the call.
Beautiful.
Hi, everybody.
Dr. Angel, welcome.
Mr. Marley, hello.
Let's see. Okay. Review discussion of board statutes for possible future legislation.
So, this is Kurt Winter. As you guys have your materials, and we staff are trying to make some changes as well as maybe made some other alterations and things like that based on the discussion of 9-2 to present to you today. I wanted to make a note that any changes that the L&R committee wishes to move forward with, board staff does plan to have maybe some national councils or other groups look at the L&R committee's proposed changes, possibly prior to it going to the board for opinions and such, and bring it back to the L&R committee. And just so you're aware of kind of a board staff's plan.
I think that's prudent. Any other thoughts on that?
Okay.
Yep.
The what our staff did, and I should say myself, took the recommendations from the L&R committee at the last meeting, and I basically created two bills, not precisely as the L&R had suggested. I was wanting to know if the composition statutes of the board membership ought to be added to the home inspector statute changes, omitting the addition of an engineer and only requesting the addition of a home inspector member or an alarm agent or alarm industry member. And with the L&R committee's thoughts, or having that go as a single package, possibly board staff, myself, opinion was that it would be easier to get that through altogether, showing that we would like the home inspector added to the board roster, as well as these other home inspector changes. All right, let me bring that up so you can see what it looks like.
That would be helpful. I'm on a single little screen today, so I don't have the privilege of being able to pull up our packet and have everybody's smiling face on my screen.
Can everyone remotely see that?
Yeah.
So, last LNR committee meeting, it was proposed changing number two to two professional engineers, one of which being a structural engineer or civil engineer, removing one of the public members, reducing it to five public members, as well as adding the one certified home inspector and controlling person alarm agent. This proposal here is, instead of having this particular statute change go along with the definitions change, but to be with the home inspector changes, and it felt like a cleaner, more easily defendable package in this manner. But I wanted to get the LNR committee's opinion on that change, if the LNR committee thinks it's important to have the additional engineers added on at this time, and so forth.
Dr. Angel, you have a question.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think, and Kurt, I was thinking, me personally, I'd like to request the addition of the additional engineer.
I agree.
Two reasons. I mean, one, as we've talked before, half of the board registrants are engineer, and half of those are civil. So there's a need for additional expertise in that front, especially if the one board member is not available. I just don't know what the political calculus is, but maybe another way to look at it is, you know, we try it, we explain why we think it's important, and if there's something we need to compromise on, that's maybe we give it up, but at least ask because we think it's the right thing. I don't think we should just ignore it.
That's fine. Is that the opinion of the committee in whole, I would imagine?
Why did we drop that one engineer?
No, this was just a proposal from staff for you guys to comment on and think about.
I
think it's necessary to have
them. As the landscape architect that has worked with engineers for 55 years, I really think that we need that extra engineer on there.
Very good. I
think so too.
As the committee had talked about last time, is that this would be included with the definition bill, and I just add the language as it was before, moving forward with that.
Yeah. Now, Kurt, go ahead.
I was going to say, so the language will be two engineers. One of them has to be a civil engineer. Is that what we're saying?
Yes,
correct.
And civil engineering is 50% of the... Okay.
And how does that, Peter speaking, how does that affect the rest of the makeup? Does it drop the public members to five?
That was the proposition at the last meeting, yes.
Yeah, that's what I would do.
I agree. I basically go back to the original language.
Very good. Thank you guys for commenting on that. I feel the language under the rest of the home inspectors might be an easier discussion than the others, so maybe we can get through it quickly. The Home Inspector Rules and Standards Committee had looked at these statutes that and made comments on that. I don't know if Mr. Leeds would like to comment on that.
Well, yeah, 32-103.
So the makeup of the committee, I think the Home Inspector Committee didn't have any issues with the language.
Yeah, the committee, Peter speaking, the committee had no problem with five members, although we feel that having five members in on home inspectors in the same room is pretty tough, but it's probably a good idea. But they did want to do alternate terms. Two members appointed by the committee. Where does it say that? They, I don't see that you got that in there.
I apologize. Let me get to it here. It's right here. This, at the last meeting.
Yeah, staggered 3-year terms as opposed to five years all at the same time. Other than that, they had no problems with it. With everything that we talked about last beginning of the month.
Kurt, this is Ed Morley. Any Any thoughts or any feedback from the alarm community on including them on the board? I don't want to create a position and then not have anyone willing to participate.
I have not recently. I have spoken with those who are part of the alarm industry who have come to the office. And those who are part of the larger organizations, like ADT or something like that. Those individuals are the ones who are more interested in the creation of rules and an update of statutes and so forth. I have not spoken to them recently, but I know there is that. Judith and I will be going to an Alarm Agent Association convention in October. It'll be the first time the board has appeared at said convention. We're going to have our own booth, and I imagine we'll be doing some outreach at that point as well.
Good. Okay. Mr. Marlin?
Yes.
Just to that same point, I was thinking back to the board composition. Does it make sense? Because I think when we say reducing the public members, that might be a red flag for a lot of people. And, you know, the home inspectors have certainly expressed interest in being part of the board. I think the alarms have not, maybe to the same extent. And, you know, what they're asking for doesn't necessarily require a board position. What if we were to simply keep the board at 13 or increase it to 13 by adding one home inspector and one engineer, but keep the public members as is and not add a alarm agent at this time? Just based on registering population and express desire to be on the board, that seems to be a better starting point for me.
Other opinions or comments?
I would agree, Mr. Bed. I would agree.
Yeah, I think that's a very good idea.
Okay, I agree with that also.
Peter speaking. When do the alarm people meet? Do they meet here at all?
There's no alarm committee or any board affiliated organization that I'm aware of.
So they just send the money and get certified. That's it. They don't really have any input in anything else. I was wondering because I agree with Dr. Angel that if they're not really an entity that actually comes in and sits at this table, I don't suspect you're going to find somebody to do just that. I'm in agreement with everyone else.
And I feel that if we were to defend the changes and if we were asked, why are you not including this other occupation profession, and we could probably defend it by saying that we haven't received any reach out indicating that there's interest in that.
Yeah.
Well, they also have no enforcement advisory or anything like that, right?
No enforcement advisory,
no rules and standards. I don't see that they even have a presence in the building.
We do
receive complaints on alarm.
And how do you justify those, research those complaints?
So we have different types of complaints. If it's like a door-to-door doing alarm business without the proper, alarm agent certification, controlling person, alarm business. If their firm is expired, their alarm business is expired, and they're practicing, they're doing business with an expired alarm agent, controlling person.
And staff and investigators take care of those complaints by themselves?
Correct.
So there's no alarm person with any input in that, right?
No.
Okay.
Staff.
Generally, to me, they see more black and white issues about being licensed or not being licensed, having the proper authorizations, and not so much about the technical ability of the person, like it's the case more with home inspectors or engineers and architects and everybody else.
This is Kurt Winter. I think I've only recalled one such case going before the board regarding technical competency, and because there are no rules or standards in which the board has to base off any if you did or did not have the technical knowledge and skill to do it. It was very, we really couldn't do anything with that. And that was like, I think I can only think of one case in like the last 6 years that I've been here where that ever came up. Usually it is just black and white. Were you certified at the time you did, or were you not?
Kurt, and I think we, you know, maybe we do need to take a look at making rules for him. Mm-hmm. But at the end, if you have one board position to add, and it's between one where you see a case every 6 years and one where you see three cases every month, to me, that makes the case for why you prefer the engineer at that point.
Very good.
I agree.
Okay. I think we're good on board composition now.
I wanted to point out one other thing with the home inspectors, which was the language regarding financial assurance and the language regarding a valid fingerprint clearance card. At the last meeting, Deanie, the AAG, had brought up if she did not, she wasn't sure if the board was allowed to have an automatic suspension, automatic revocation of a registration. And her and I had a discussion with Mark Harris at the AAG's office regarding the board's ability to do so. I guess the gist of that was that, yes, the board statutes does allow it if you can basically prove that it's in the public interest. You know, a home inspector does not have financial insurance, thereby the public is possibly in danger if some position or the work was done while they did not have that, so the board is allowed to take this automatic action. I don't know if Scott can maybe say it better, but that's what I got out of it, and so that seemed to be a clear route to being able to create E, as you see here, regarding the fingerprint clearance card.
Yeah, I can't add a whole lot simply because I can't, as the board's attorney, I can't take part necessarily in the substantive portion of any discussion. But what I can say is that, yes, there are circumstances under which there can be an automatic administrative action taken with regards to a license pursuant to the board statutes, and whether or not it's in the public interest is certainly a factor, as well as whether or not there is any discretion attached to the decision. So, for example, if you have a situation where somebody expires on a certain date, and then by statute, the license, there is a 30-day grace period given. At the end of the 30 days, on the 31st day, there's an expiration by statute. That is perfectly allowable, because that is not a discretionary decision made by anybody. It's a quantifiable situation, and it is in the public interest that that individual not continue to practice when they're not at that point met the licensing requirement. So there are circumstances under which the board can have that automatic function occur.
Thank you, Scott. And, I think actually this had come up in the home inspector meeting and not the last L&R committee where Deanie raised the question.
But thanks for clarifying that, Kurt. A wordsmithing thing, and maybe it's just how this is ordered. Should we move E up to become D and D down to become E? Because D seems like kind of a summary statement that would just, I think the text would flow better if it was the last statement instead of really. There we go. Get rid of that.
Thank you for that. Yeah, that's a quick, it makes sense.
Okay, any other comments or input on this section? Hearing none, let's move along.
Okay, so at the last committee meeting, the committee had asked the board locate the definitions in the model laws of the national councils, place them in here, and they are now, I have done so, and they refer you to review and make comments upon and what you think about these changes. So let me go down to, looks like this is first architecture.
This is one of the sitting in cardboard ones. I probably ought to say it's great. Actually, I think it looks fine.
Okay. Do you feel that this is clearer than the previous language that's scratched out here in the red?
I believe so. I think it actually contains a lot of the same language, but I think I like the subparagraphs. Because there are certain things that become kind of less clear, particularly people who may be coming in from out of state to practice. I think this helps to clarify. So I think it looks good on the architect side.
Any other comments?
No.
So we'll go down to engineering. So when I was looking at NC's definition, it was actually very, very, very close to the board's definition. I wouldn't say it exactly mirrors it, but you can tell that the definition was probably created looking at NC's definition. What has been scratched out was just language that was not in NC's, so the additional language starting here at AND. This was a recent change of the clearly, used to be potentially, and this would be the committee saying we would like potentially back in. I don't know what the legislature would think of that, but that's how NC's has it. As well as including this language about incidental practice of engineering and with regards to survey and explaining that a little bit more in this section here, which is how it is in NC's model law. And then we have obviously the mining bit has been moved, and then this language here is kind of redundant because it's covered in other statutes such as 145. So this language isn't entirely gone from the Boards Practice Act, but it is kind of duplicative of another statute elsewhere. It doesn't necessarily need to be here.
Sir, just my two cents on it. I think I'm good with mirroring NCS more closely. I have no problem with the deletions that you have. I think the one word change up on top from clearly to potentially is much better for the board when it comes to enforcement, because clearly it's a very high bar to clear, and sometimes you can't prove anything clearly until something bad has happened. So NCS intentionally uses potentially. So even though it looks minor, I think it's important and I like it. I also like the idea of clarifying that land surveying should be incidental to engineering. We don't want engineering doing boundary surveys or anything else. Then my one question where you have highlighted teaching engineering design courses, I would probably remove that because over 90% of the college professors in engineering are not PEs. And, you know, they're not really practicing. They're teaching. Texas, for example, has so another way to do it. I would remove it, but another way to do it is to do what Texas does. I think in Texas, if you're a professor and you have a PhD in that branch and you're teaching, then you get exempt from the examination and the other requirements. They basically give you a PE, so you can say you're a PE and teach. But I think it's easier to just remove that requirement.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, most definitely.
Okay. Any other comments?
No, I too support changing clearly to potentially.
Does the teaching show up, the teaching aspect, did it show up anywhere else in these rules? I mean, like for the architects or for the, anybody? Because Dr. Angel is right. Most of the teachers in any of these fields are not actually professional engineers or architects in
or
the schools
architects.
Or in the or even in the home inspection field. You know, the teachers do not have to be that way. So does that show up anywhere else in your rules? I didn't see.
Just when people are applying, it's basically if you have, maybe Julie can help me here, that teaching experience can go towards experience for licensure, but only a year's worth max.
Right.
Okay. All right. I really want to know what you guys think of this geology.
Obviously, the geologists are God.
Wow.
Everything from everything that touches dirt is in there.
When I first, this is Doug, when I first read that, my initial reaction was, wow, that's way too long. But as I went back to the model of law from ASBOG, and I mean, that is what they have. So to me, it's, okay, well, this has been reviewed by all states that have state geologists and approved. So in that sense, it's pretty defensible.
Mm-hmm.
It's just
long. It just makes me afraid to stick a stake in my backyard.
You better not be here.
What does the,
are you saying that by the time you read this, geology has taken place? It takes geologic time to read it. Yes.
So I'm looking at some of the, there's a few key words that popped out at me that just based on the geographic location, but then I got to thinking about, well, we do have volcanoes or dormant ones or dead ones or something, so volcanology might have to stay anyway. That was one word that jumped out, but I'm backpedaling on that now.
No, there are active volcanic fields in Arizona. So,
yep. Yeah, there are. So, yeah, that's why I'm backpedaling. So, sorry.
Volcanoes are dormant until they're not, right?
Yep,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And someday the sleeping giant will awaken. I think it's fine.
Do you feel that it is clearer than the language that has been scratched out?
That's a good question.
It's a lot more specific.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about clearer. I think it covers more.
I wish it was more than one.
I wish there was something in between. I feel like the current definition is way too narrow, or maybe not broad enough, I guess. And then the new one is like, wow.
I especially like the furthermore.
If you look at the model law, that's not even all of it. It keeps going. So it's a crazy definition for sure.
Does the committee have any issue with this definition being so specific while the definitions of the other professions are not so specific? If there's a difference in how are out there.
I, as the architect, I have no problem with it.
Yeah, I don't see a problem either. I don't think it changes how we enforce or the authority of the board, so I'm comfortable with it.
One thing you could take out is coastal geology. We don't have any coasts.
Yeah, that's true.
Not yet.
No, until California slides into
right.
the ocean. then we'll put it back in.
If it was put before the legislators, the defense would be that it's taking from model law of a national council, and that's what the board has done with the other definitions, and
right.
the board is therefore just is being consistent in
right.
these changes.
That's why I'm reluctant to do any editing of it, because I would like to be able to say it's what ASBOG came up with.
Yep. I agree.
one little pet peeve I have is groundwater is not hyphenated. We gave that up about 25 years ago, so.
We could make that change. if you could find it.
Yeah, Eric, good luck finding it.
That's a deep subject.
Moving right along.
right. This is the landscape architect. So you can see here, a little shorter than the last.
And where is this from, Kurt?
Clarb.
Clarb. Clarb's not a law.
I find it kind of strange the word landscape architecture is in the definition.
Leroy, any comments, thoughts?
This has been gone over so many times by Clarb, and I don't have any problem as long as it's a model.
Okay. And do you feel it's clearer than the board's scratched out language?
Good here.
Any other comments?
No.
Nothing here. All right. Move on to the next one. Land surveying.
Sorry, I was trying to pull up the NCWS version. Is this pretty much verbatim from that, Kurt?
It is, and that's why if I had a question about the language, I highlighted it here.
Okay. So what was your question about expert technical testimony?
The board, it had come up in the past where the board was trying to determine whether or not expert testimony was the practice of a professional practice. The board had, I think the L&R committee created a substantive policy, which the board put through, saying that yes, it was professional practice, and then within 6 months had backtracked and decided that it was better put to the courts to decide who's an expert witness and not for the particular cases. And the question had come up because there are individuals out there who maybe are not registered with the board but act as expert witnesses producing documents or opinions, and whether or not those should be sealed. And so I just highlighted it because I didn't know if that's the board's interpretation's kind of been back and forth on that regarding that, and I think the current one is that an expert witness doesn't necessarily need to be licensed.
Right. I would look at expert testimony because, I mean, I've done some of that myself, similar to what we look at with property descriptions. If a surveyor does it, it's part of our professional services. There's no law in Arizona that says a surveyor has to write the legal description. Anybody can write a legal description, but if it's done under a surveying practice, then it has to be sealed. So that's how I would look at it, is that if it's done under the surveying license and done by a surveyor, then that has to follow our rules.
And Mike, I think that's what, and others that might have been there, please correct me, but I think that's what the discussion was, is that, first of all, it was up to a court, or up to the court in an expert witness case, to determine the qualifications of an expert witness and decide how much weight to give to that testimony. But that if the work was done by a PE, it should be sealed as a professional document. So in this case, likewise, if a surveyor were to testify and prepare a document, it should be sealed. But it doesn't mean that doing expert witness work is always a professional service.
I agree.
Peter here, Dr. Angel is right. We were both in that L&R committee meeting back then when we were talking about this. And we determined that as far as expert testimony and expert witness work goes, that's not up to anyone other than the judge himself to decide or the jury themselves to decide whether the testimony is expert and can be considered expert.
I would agree with that, yeah. But if it's done by a surveyor, then now it becomes, we have, there's several people, guys across the country that are specialize in this type of work, and all of their reports when they do that work are sealed by whatever they're in, and if they're in their state. Sometimes I know a couple of gentlemen that do this work that have been pulled into other states where they're not licensed, and the court has agreed that they are still an expert witness. And so it's, like I said, at the bottom line is it's up to the judge to make those determinations, but if a surveyor does it, then it should fall under our guidelines. Same thing with what Dr. Angel was saying with the engineers. So I don't have any problem with that verbiage in there.
But does that mean that we should remove it?
I think
might be saying that every expert witness testimony needs to be shown by a surveyor.
Right.
As a practice of the profession.
I think we do need to remove it simply for all the professions. We can't say that an expert witness in a home inspection case has to be a certified home inspector. I don't see that that's going to be feasible.
I don't see that that says that. It says that that it just lists that as one of our professional services.
Don't we say that if you practice the profession without registration, then you're violating our statute. So are they practicing the profession just because they're providing expert witness?
It could be read that way.
Yeah.
But we could always qualify it, expert with technical testimony by a registered land surveyor. But I don't know. I'm not going to die on that hill. But
let's look at it from another perspective. I don't think we have that any reference to expert technical testimony in any of the other definitions.
No, that's not correct. In the geology, it's included.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's in there? Okay, sorry. Notice how much to read in geology. I missed that part.
All right. Understandable.
Oh, there it is. Okay. So we have it in geology. Do we have it in engineering? I find it interesting that NCWS would put it in the land surveyor and not in the engineering definition.
It's because the different committees made up of different professions at NCES. Yeah. So that, you know, the surveyors decide what they want to put in and the engineers what they want to put in.
Yeah. I guess if we're going to remove it from surveying, let's remove it from geology. And that way we're consistent across all of the definitions, would be my recommendation.
I agree, because frankly, removing it doesn't mean that if there was an egregious case, we couldn't enforce. It doesn't say that we're not regulating it. It's just, it doesn't force us to conflict with courts, potentially.
Right.
All right. I agree with that.
And I can say, as a geologist, I've done expert witness work in other states where I'm not registered. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that's very common. You're an expert, so you're called upon.
And like I said, I know surveyors that have been pulled into other states because of common rules and different things like that are not registered in those states, that the court still recognizes them as an expert. So, yeah. All right.
I feel that, okay. Peter here, I feel that the court will recognize whatever they want, but what we don't want to do is we don't want to hurt one of our professions or someone who does expert witness work that's not registered. It's the other end of the pencil that I'm concerned with.
Unlike engineers, even though it's also NCES, the language did not mirror it or was not as close as the engineer. So sometime in the past, there was a reason to change the engineering definition, but not one for the land surveyors, is what I'm guessing.
Kurt, that was in 2020. The legislature took up the definition of engineering practice, I mean, frankly, in the context of the Mills case. So, but nothing else. So that's the story behind it.
Okay. Any other comments regarding the land surveyor?
Kurt, I have one comment on the geology one again. I'm sorry. There's a reference to Addendum A, but I don't think there is one, right? Is that correct?
Correct. Not in this, so it's
maybe you already took it out.
It's possible. Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at the model law version of it, so you may have taken it out.
Yeah, I might have already done so.
Okay. It's okay.
What's next?
I think that's it as far as the definitions. I know I probably asked this the last meeting, but again, I wanted to ask, did we want the separate, so we have registered professional engineer and then we have engineer, and I would assume, and Dr. Angie, you can tell me, that's because of the 2020 bill taking NCs and having those two separated from one another, because the other professions don't have that, where you have the definition of engineer and you have the definition of a registered professional engineer. Do we want...
Correct. Go ahead.
What does the committee think? Should there be two definitions per profession or a single? I would say when you say single, I mean I'm scratching out engineer.
I think single is sufficient because we're only regulating the register practice.
Sorry for all the scrolling. No, I already have it scratched. Okay.
I think, Kurt, if you are going to reach out to NCES and other professional organizations, maybe, I know when you looked at states, it looked like there were only a handful of states out of the 50 that had definitions for engineer. So maybe ask NCES what's the point behind having another definition. I suspect it might be to clarify that, you know, that's not regulated, but I think by just regulating registered PEs, you're doing that already, and it takes you the effort of creating separate definitions for every profession without the word registered, and that's why we're adding it. So I'd lean towards having it without it, but if NCS has a good reason to include that definition, we should probably pay attention.
Okay. That makes sense to me. It's easier to scratch out one than to add, you know, four others.
Yeah. Yep.
I like it.
Any other comments regarding the definitions?
Thank you.
That's good.
Okay.
I only have one question. Does a land surveyor have to consult with a geologist before he does his work?
He does touch dirt. I don't know.
All right, I'll shut up.
Only if we're setting stone monuments.
Yeah.
We don't do that anymore, so we're okay there. So,
I don't know if there was any changes from the last time regarding 32106.02, where this was the narrowing and being more specific about the board's powers regarding, or excuse me, jurisdiction and authority over non-registrants. Scott, had you had a chance to look at this?
Yes, to a degree, but again, there's a limit to how much I can engage in a substantive discussion regarding it.
Certainly. I think Deeney had asked us to add number 4, and then the committee had asked to mm-hmm. add number 1 with the cease and desist letter. I guess yeah. I could ask a question to you, Scott, because the board currently doesn't have a cease and desist mechanism. Do you currently work for any other board or have, can you tell us anything about what that entails, a cease and desist?
I'll give you kind of a quick thumbnail sketch, and I'll also give you a little bit of a caution. Cease and desist is a bit of a double-edged sword. In the North Carolina Dental Board legal structure. Having the authority to send a cease and desist, a board can be granted that authority. I do not presently have a board that has or exercises that authority, and I generally would be inclined to caution the board to be very careful in exercising that authority because it's very easy to give the appearance of entering into a sort of a protectionist stance with regard to an area of professional licensure. So while a cease and desist is something that boards are able to use from time to time, I've generally found that injunctive remedy is equally beneficial, but it has the advantage of proceeding through the court system. So when you have an injunction, you have a document that is you've proceeded through a hearing process, as opposed to a cease and desist, which opens you up to a bit more of an argument regarding potential arbitrary use of authority.
Would you say number 4 would kind of cover the injunction because the board would be able to send it to, you know, the AAG's office or another entity?
Well, not necessarily, simply because number 4 is going to be different from an injunction. In number 4, what you're doing is typically, you'd be referring something to another agency for an investigation under their statutes and rules. For example, if you became aware of a situation in which a licensee or somebody may have committed a criminal violation or something, you could refer it to the criminal division of the Attorney General's office or to a prosecuting agency. You could refer it to another agency that may, if you have a licensee who's engaged in something that additionally could constitute a violation of, say, an accountancy statute, you could refer it to the Board of Accountancy for investigation. Typically, you wouldn't be referring it to another agency to seek an injunction. The board has injunctive remedy authority, and you wouldn't really refer it to another agency to pursue an injunction as much as refer it for an investigation under their statutes and rules for a potential violation of something else.
So that doesn't need to necessarily be spelled out here.
Well, when you say it doesn't necessarily have to be spelled out here, you mean in terms of for what you would be referring the matter or?
The injunction, the board, you don't have to say the board has the ability to issue an injunction. listed under this?
Well, injunctive remedy, the board already has, and I have to look up under what provision, but in fact the board has a, I believe has an injunction against one individual whom you simply have not been able to serve. But the board has actually pursued injunctive remedy in the past. I'm just looking up really quickly the
probably under 32.128.
Let's see. Yeah, under, under 128. You wouldn't have injunctive remedy under 128 because injunctive remedy is generally when somebody is not a licensee. Once somebody has been revoked, or if somebody is practicing without a license, you would be pursuing injunctive remedy.
It's already there. It's under.
Yeah, it's already
26F.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
If I'm not mistaken, this is Peter here. Wasn't the purpose of this? Us working this rule was simply number three, to be sure that it goes to a hearing and doesn't just disappear under the bookshelf when, you know, if no one's taking any action.
Right. It's supposed to allow the respondent to have some kind of ability to make the board take action, so the board can't just sit on the case forever.
Even if the respondent doesn't do anything, it's saying that after a certain period, the board better do something. Isn't that what that number three says?
Correct. Mm-hmm. If they just do not participate, either with the investigation or an informal settlement, or, you know, then the board can proceed to a hearing, or
right.
Shall, based on the language here.
Yeah. I believe that's why we got into this rule to begin with.
I guess, does the committee have any opinions or comments regarding what Scott has talked about?
I like it the way it is.
I think it's fine.
I was at Clear last week, so I apologize. I was not able to reach out to try to get additional information regarding number six here, under exemptions regarding the wastewater or water treatment plant systems.
Kurt, so this is an area that I think is beyond the technical expertise of definitely for me and probably others on the call as well, so... Is there a benefit to gathering input from our registrant population and just say, hey, we're considering updating this exemption. Does anybody have input on, you know, what they would like, what would be a reasonable exemption, and see what people come up with?
I think there is. As you know, because we had these discussions at other L&R committees, there's definitely a lot of opinions out there regarding it, and I can definitely probably reach out to the exact same parties who we reached out at those times to get their input.
Yeah, I think in the end, if nobody has any input on it, whether it's you know, ADQ or registrants or anybody, maybe we just leave it alone. I mean, we've been open to look at it, but I worry about creating... unforeseen issues. The way it reads right now is that exemption is so small that very few people fall under it. And maybe that's what it needs to be, unless we have a good reason for the exemption or our understanding.
If I understand you, Doctor, do you mean leave it alone to the original 25?
Yeah. Unless we can hear from people who know what they're doing, and they tell us what's, you know, reasonable and why, then I think we change it. But if nobody cares enough about it to even suggest changes, whether it's ADHD or registrant, then why do we want to change it and then potentially create an issue?
Well, I know we've had input in the past that the $12,500 doesn't buy you anything these days. That was, gosh, a year ago. And we just decided to leave it where it was because we didn't know what, quite frankly, we didn't know what to do with it when we were looking at it based on the dollar amount. I think last meeting we discussed if we changed it to a capacity, then we're not tied to dollars anymore. It's kind of like the exemption for commercial construction. You got 3,000 square feet or whatever it happens to be. I think this kind of gives us at least something that's a little more tangible and keeps it more in that residential realm. Well, it is, but and it keeps it in the residential realm. So I guess I'm comfortable leaving it at the 3,000, but I would like I'd like to get some buy-in from somebody that's an expert in this field, which is definitely not me.
But it may be an idea, Ed, is, Kurt, do we, I mean, we've had several cases with septic come up where we've put together committees. I mean, is there anybody who served in any of those committees able to review and provide suggestions?
I'm sure they can. I believe I still have all of their contact information just from those other conversations that we've had. And I will definitely reach out to them. I think that was what I wanted to do prior, but again, time got away from me because of the conference.
I know.
This is Peter. I thought we were into this specifically because the board was being asked their opinion on this. They keep coming back, don't they? Keep coming back to us and saying, you know, maybe the board ought to check this out. Isn't that how we got into this to begin with? Wasn't the wastewater people, they were concerned with the difference between systems and plants, and nobody really knew whether they needed to be certified or not. The towns, one town in particular, I don't think it was Mesa, someplace maybe up north, that came to us for our opinion on this.
Snowflake Taylor.
Huh?
Yeah, I think
we had
that sounds familiar.
Snowflake Taylor.
And I think that's why we're here to begin with.
Just because of those previous conversations, and since we were already updating the statute, it seemed like a time to possibly be able to make a change if there is one. So I had.
Well, if nobody's asking for our opinion, I say I'm with Dr. Angel. I say leave it alone and let someone else worry about it.
What year was that $12,500 put in there?
1980s.
80s. Okay, so if you escalate the, you know, whatever $12,500 was in the 80s to now, right, it's some amount.
Mm-hmm.
And
it is. From those previous conversations, I think people don't want to have a dollar amount because then 20 years later, are we going to think about it again? Because
I was going to say if, you know, what you could build in 1988 and for $12,500, what's the equivalent to today, you know, size-wise?
I know, but I guess what I'm saying too is that 20, like let's say we put that through, and then 20 years from now that amount doesn't do anything.
No, I'm not saying, I'm saying if it's 3,000 gallons, I don't know what the right number is, but if you could build a 3,000 gallon system for that amount of money in 1988, what can you build today for the equivalent, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we'd still tie it, whatever that was based on, we would still tie it to just that capacity.
Right.
I like the idea of keeping it capacity based rather than dollar based because then we're not subject to inflation.
Well, is the intent to limit us to a single family occupancy, right? We don't want to have a non-registrant designing for like 20 houses or for a small community.
That's why we picked 3,000. Yeah. They could do like the residential exemption, I think, is for 2 units or something like that, maybe 3. And
is that defined somewhere?
Yeah.
I think it's in the paragraphs just up above. So we were thinking it could be a couple units connected to one 3,000 gallon tank.
No more than 20 persons.
Well, that's commercial.
3,000 feet, and it's the one above that, I believe, Kurt.
I thought we had a residential. A detached single family, or okay.
Doesn't give a number.
Doesn't. Single family.
Unless an individual or unit or multifamily dwelling.
Well, that's for...
Yeah, I think you're right that we need a gallon amount. That's the best way to do it. Otherwise, you play games of forever.
So let's try to get somebody to verify if 3,000 is a reasonable number.
I will do so. We'll reach out. I think we were okay with all these other items before. And our last discussion with Dean was here. We had moved language around and so forth. Was there any other comments or opinions regarding the changes here? Kind of.
No.
Nope, I'm good.
This was the exemptions from examination. I think Julie here had a comment. Do we need this in here since it's not waiving anything?
I thought the same thing.
Yeah, because basically it's saying if you want this, you have to take the exam for that branch, right?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So it's not an exemption from examination.
Yeah, in my could it fit under the requirements for registration or whatever it is? Where we say you need, you know, to pass the examination and you need the experience and blah, blah, blah. I think we could move that there and say that if you register in a branch of engineering and you want another designation, you need to pass the examination.
Yeah, if it's not already referenced there, I would say move it up to the up to that section.
We have 32.122.01 for change, but Julie, if this was scratched out, what we see on the screen right now, if somebody said, I want to become a structural engineer and they're already a civil engineer, you would just have them go through the regular application process, right?
Correct.
There wouldn't be anything different. We would still look at their education, experience, exams, based upon their request to be a structural engineer. Correct?
Yes.
There might not need this language to be specifically added. I think our current process would be prove it to us just like you proved to be a civil.
So basically we strike that's both of those paragraphs for the paragraph B.
Sorry, this is Julie. I think I had spoken to Judith about this, and I think it could be interpreted that someone who's a civil and wants the structural could take the structural exam but not have to show all of the other registration requirements.
Don't have to show experience.
Right.
Just or educate. You've taken the exam.
Which, to be honest, to me it makes sense. I mean, if someone has already been registered, hasn't had discipline, and demonstrates technical competency through passing the exam, I'd be all for making the registration process easier instead of asking them to provide, you know, transcripts and certificates of experience again and everything else.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I would agree with that.
Maybe we need to
open up that section.
Yeah, I think it would
right here. And move it up.
Yeah, I think it would fit better in the registration statute.
And just another thing, you could always change the title, exemptions from examination or education or experience requirements. Would that fit, or is it better to try to get it into 32.126.1?
It needs to be moved.
Okay. That could probably be added to this this bill in its entirety, and I can try to show that for next time.
Okay.
And then B, I think it's unchanged since we looked at it last time, with the fundamentals.
Yep, looks good.
Under the comedy, at Clear, I got a nice discussion about compacts and endorsement, and I think I was using endorsement incorrectly, as I think what we were looking for is comedy, where somebody's licensed elsewhere can approve it to us and then it can be registered more swiftly, as opposed to reciprocity or a compact where they just kind of can work here without even registering. So I just want to clarify that I did not know the difference, and now I do, and comedy would probably be the preferred term. Julie had pointed out for engineers, because we have 17 branches, currently, you know, Julie,
yeah,
you
sorry.
Might just jump
yeah,
in.
Yeah, sorry. I think the committee did touch on this a bit last time, but yes, Arizona is branch specific for engineering, and so adding this statute, I mean, just for discussion-wise, how would that work if someone's coming from another state as a professional engineer, not professional civil engineer, or, you know, how would we just license them by endorsement here, you know, not knowing what their specialty is in that other state? If, you know, if we're going by this statute, it's just showing that they're licensed in another state for 5 years, or that they're NCES, you know, certified. How would we know which branch to license them in here in Arizona? And do we need...
Julie, I think...
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I think it's a judgment call. Because I think the downside of not having branches is more than the downside of not knowing where to license them. So I would say, you know, one, sometimes NCES keeps track or their letter says which exam people passed, right? Maybe that wasn't there before, but I know in a lot of cases it is, so maybe that's one solution. The other one is when you receive the, maybe you ask people to self-declare what branch they're pursuing, they want to get registered in.
But I'm just concerned, I guess, about someone coming in, took the civil exam, but then declares that they want the structural license, right? Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if we need to add specific language to that it will be based on their exam that they took, or, you know, their education on their council record, or, you know, what that would look
like.
If they have a council record.
One thing that you've got is you've got state agencies, for example, that have civil engineers, and even at ADOT, most of our bridge engineers are civil engineers. They're not structural engineers. And even the organization, they're pretty much civil engineers.
Yeah, and literally that's in large part because we don't protect the practice of structural engineer, right? Any civil can practice structural. We protect the title.
Yeah.
You can't call yourself a structural. But you are requiring them under 3A2 to demonstrate active practice for 5 years in that state or territory. And that's, how are they demonstrated that active practice? Are they providing experience certificates?
I think for the purpose of this statute and comedy or reciprocity, it would just be showing license verification from that other state that they've been licensed for 5 years.
Like a board action date from that state and they've been active in that period.
Yeah, no, I don't. I think that would kind of, that's the point, right? Like not requiring COEs for this.
Yeah, I think the concern I have there, though, then is the term active practice. There's a difference between having an active license and having active practice. Mm-hmm. Active practice means I've been, as an architect, actually providing architectural services for 5 years. Mm-hmm. I have 8 other licenses in my quiver that I've only got one of them that would fall under active practice right now, and that's Virginia. All the other ones, they just sit there. So we have to be careful when we what we're asking for.
I'm not familiar with the process for reciprocity comedy, you know, in another state, obviously, because we don't have that so much. What does that typically look like applying for that?
So, you know, from an architectural standpoint, most states with comedy or reciprocity, we would look at active practice, which means you would actually be practicing for those 5 years. So you'd have to provide some verification, probably signed off by a partner or a colleague or something that says Ed Marley has been actively practicing architecture in Arizona for the last 5 years. And I think the other thing we have to be careful of is we say at least 5 years, we don't say which 5 years. Is it 5 years 30 years ago, or is it 5 years, the most current 5 years? And maybe that's not a big deal. I don't know. I'm playing devil's advocate here. Who's, you know, what might go wrong with this?
In surveying it seems to depend more on a lot of the states. It's from when your original license was issued as far as education requirements go and things like that. So, like, New Mexico's had their four-year degree program for a long time, so anybody that's, you know, licensed from, you know, the mid-90s on up, you're not going to get a license in New Mexico unless you go get a degree. Most of the other states that have recently, within the last few years, activated, you know, some type of education requirements like Colorado or Utah, they look at when you were originally licensed and that you have no complaints. So, you know, you have to get a certificate from your Board of Technical Registration or whatever, to, you know, that you're in good standing with them. But it's all based around the education requirements, because ours are changing. Every state, though, has its own state-specific exam for its own, you know, statutes and things like that. So there's no direct transfer of license for a surveyor anywhere at this time.
Yep. And I think in survey, that's a very clear issue. In engineering, I'm not very concerned about it. I think we ought to make it as easy as we can. Ask people to self-certify that they have been active for 5 years. I don't know. The one clause I might consider is making sure they haven't had disciplinary history in any state over the last 5 years. I mean, that would sort of at least show that if they've been practicing, they've been clean. If they haven't been practicing, then they still haven't gotten in trouble. I mean, they would self-certify that they've been practicing.
Does the term in good standing cover the disciplinary adequately?
I think good standing to me means that it's active and not suspended or
paid your dues.
Yeah.
Well, in the application process, you've got the references, and maybe that could be strengthened just a little bit in those references, at least for the most current reference from a supervisor. But generally they tell even what the quality of work of the person has been in those references.
But I think what we're saying, Leroy, is maybe not require those references. If somebody's registered in another state, just basically say, oh, you're registered in California? Yeah, we'll give you an Arizona license. So what do we need to know before we do that? And Jill is bringing up the question of what branch are we licensing on? And the other question is, how do we know that they know what they're doing? And again, for me, that second one is, as long as they have no disciplinary history, we sort of have to trust the other jurisdictions that they're doing their job. The branch are more complicated, but I'd probably start by asking them to self-declare.
I'm okay with that.
If they want to be structural, Julie, then you could say, okay, show me proof that you passed the 16 hours, because that's a requirement in Arizona to become a structural.
So, I think the only thing that I have against with comedy, of course, is the more that we ask proof of, the more it seems there's no point to the comedy. why not just go through the normal way of getting an application through and showing us your experience and everything else, and that you're licensed wherever you're at and you're in good standing in those states, don't have disciplinary action, criminal convictions, and so forth. How do we keep it that it's an easy path for licensure, but still protecting the public?
Can it be something where we issue the license, but then, I mean, we, the requirements, we say no disciplinary history, but we issue the license and then go back and check that there hasn't been one?
Well, I think we can check disciplinary, at least an architect, if the states that they're coming from report to the NCARB disciplinary database, we can check it as a part of the application process. We don't have to wait until we grant.
Julie, do we, if we look at a National Council record, and we would be able to, obviously how it's written now, 3B, they can just give us a council record, that, and we would be able to look at their experience and all of that just through that. And that would, of course, be the easiest line that I see, that we can probably look at just that and make a determination. If they say you want to be structural and that shows that, would that be correct of me to say that?
Yes, yeah, council records I show, yeah, everything, the exams, education, experience. I just, my fear is that this is not specific enough, right? So like what Dr. Angel was saying, you know, if they want the structural, then just check to see if they have the structural exam. Mm-hmm. Whereas this is just saying if they have a council record, then we can license them by endorsement. And it doesn't really mention anything about the disciplinary action here.
Surely would it help if we made, like B, the council record, make it A, so that's the primary route, and that's the simplest. I think if you meet that one, then you're done. If you don't meet that one, then your plan B now is to show us that you have a license issued by another state, that you haven't had discipline. And again, I think we can let people self-certify, and if we find that they lied on their application, that's reason for reassessing.
Does the National Council Records for Engineers, will it tell us the exam? Not always 100% of the time.
Most
of the time it will.
And so I wonder, you know, specifically again for engineers, obviously, if it needs to say the national, you know, they hold a certificate of in good standing by a national council and have the exam in the discipline, you know, in which they're seeking.
What percentage of engineers have national council review? I just reviewed a landscape architect that didn't have a CLARB.
Say a good amount, like maybe 50%, I guess.
50%?
I can see that because it's more applicable to the engineering practices because it's more even across the board there. I know a few surveyors that do it, but most of the ones that they have licenses in they don't really practice in those states. It's not as practical for a surveyor to have that, but an engineer, I understand that. I know a lot of engineers that have that record, so.
I think this is one of the things that the legislature is going to want to see, and that, you know, tries to move the needle and to make it easier for people to practice in Arizona. I'd be careful not to eliminate it or not to complicate it. I think to the extent that we can put simple safeguards, we should try it.
Yep, I agree.
I know there are some issues. I'm also thinking that it appears to be easier with this language for those who are not in the state to come in and work than, say, newly graduates. I just remember some individuals who may take an NCES exam or do their undergraduate in a specific realm of engineering, such as like environmental, wishing to be a civil, but we have to play around with their experience numbers because, oops, sorry, you didn't do a civil coursework, so you get less category hours. And also the 8 years is still there that they have to prove. I guess the only thing I'm throwing out is there a concern that it appears that it's much easier for others who are native here in Arizona to get work and to get licensed here than those who actually are already here, who have a bit more hurdles to get through for initial. Is that even a thing that I should we worry about since they kind of prove themselves elsewhere?
I want to be careful that we don't actually look at this from the standpoint of initial versus comedy licensure, because they're completely different animals. And it's always going to be a little more rigorous evaluation process on the initial registration, because we are looking at the experience levels. We're looking to ensure they pass the exam. We already have, it's already easier for a reciprocal NCARB certificate holder to potentially get licensed in Arizona because of the reduced AXP hours if we're not looking under the cover, versus an initial registrant who needs 3 years total experience for their initial in-state licensure. It already kind of happens, but that's a rules change and we're not talking about that yet. So I'm not worried about it. I think initial licensure is always going to have a little bit higher level of rigor than reciprocal registration, just by nature of the fact that they're newbies.
I agree, and to ease your mind a little bit, Kurt, I think we do have the language that says that the certificate is issued on requirements that are substantially equivalent. Yeah. If somebody took an environmental exam in another state and wants to get registered as a civil here, I mean, if they lie to us, they can lie to us, but it's not an opening for people unless they decide to lie, which they can always lie in a bunch of different ways. And then we, act accordingly.
How about this? Currently, 3A says you hold a certificate of good standing in the National Council. For someone who's doing initial, they might have that, but not have enough experience. Where somebody outside might not have enough experience, but because they hold the council record, would get it. Is that equal?
I thought you could only have a council record if you were licensed.
That's correct. Well,
Julie?
NCARB, you have a certificate. You can have a council record without being licensed.
You can have an NCES council record and not be licensed yet, technically.
Right.
But can you have a certificate? I guess then it's a matter of using the right wording, but the idea is if, you have a record that demonstrates you're licensed in a jurisdiction.
And I apologize. It does state right here, holds a certificate of qualifications.
Yep. So I think, certificate's the key word there. Both the NCWS and NCARB, I don't know about the other organizations, but they both, you can have a record without having a certificate.
Mm-hmm. But you don't need 5 years of experience also?
That's not what this is so far.
For the certificate, you mean?
Right.
I'm not sure what the exact qualifications are for each of the councils.
Yeah.
We
I think what we're saying, if you have a certification from a national council,
you're in.
We understand that you've met fairly stringent requirements and we're good with it. If you don't, we require 5 years of registration and active practice.
Okay. And as I said earlier, we will revisit the professional registration statutes for this discussion. And we could also put it in there about the certificate and getting rid of and taking a look at the 8-year experience requirements, changing those.
Did you say 8-year?
Currently, yes.
Where?
Correct.
Currently, that's the requirement for professional registration is 8 years of active engagement.
Okay.
Julie, do you have anything else regarding these?
No, I guess not. I mean, I still don't.
You're never ready.
Not, 100%. With this statute, just again, because of the branches, the branch specific of the board, but.
Julie, how many exams how many registrants do we not know what exam they took?
Not a big amount. I would say maybe 10%. 10% at most, but it's more so the, yeah, they take an exam in one branch and then declare that they want a different one here, and they're showing as a professional engineer in that other state.
Right. I mean, we could put in the application itself to say that the registration branch must match the branch for which you took the exam.
Should that be in this statute then for endorsement?
Well, I think that is already where we say that requirements are substantially equivalent to the requirements of this state. We wouldn't license someone as a civil if they took the environmental exam.
Should it also say that in A then for the council record?
Mm-hmm. I don't think it needs to. I mean, the statutes, I think if we get too specific, we might create our own issues, because those national certificates will say what license you have and what exam you took and everything else. I don't know.
Folks, I'm going to interrupt here. I have to leave. Kurt, I don't know who you want to hand this off to wrap things up, but appreciate everybody's involvement. Sorry I couldn't stay on longer, but duty calls. So thank you all, and have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good.
Yes, sir. Do we have any volunteers to continue on in Mr. Marley's stead?
Well, can't staff just take over? I mean, Kurt, you're doing a great job.
That's a good question,
Scott. I go with Leroy based on seniority.
Oh. When it comes to engineers, it'll be a short term then.
There you go.
Well, any other comments on...
I think it was, I don't know, Dr. Angel or Ed that mentioned demonstrates active practice for at least 5 years. Mm-hmm. Is it any 5 years or the most recent 5 years that we're wanting to?
Or can it be a divided 5 years?
Yeah.
5 years within the last 10 years?
Does it matter? Does it need to be specific?
At least.
Currently, we don't have anything specific for a registration.
Demonstrate active practice at least for the 5 years before application.
Yeah, you can say demonstrate active practice for at least 5 years within the most recent 10-year period to make sure that it doesn't have to be continuous, but it has to be somewhat recent.
On the application review stuff for the surveyors that I do, it asks yes or no, has the applicant been practicing or offering professional services for the most recent 10-year period? That's on the form, on the evaluation form.
I think that was added onto the forms for the waiver considerations.
That's if they were registered. Yeah, because that's part of the... Is the applicant registered in another state? So.
So it demonstrates active practice for the most recent 5 years in that state or territory.
Anything more?
I was just going to ask for, if you scroll down, Kurt, to D, where it says the board may deny regarding for a conviction. Is this where we would want to add the disciplinary action? Because there's not anything that mentions that within the last 5 years. Or?
Julie, that's a good thought, but I think this one specifically to criminal issues. I think it's different. I don't know that you can deny it just because they have a disciplinary history, but I think you might be able to direct them. I guess, I don't know, maybe you can do it. It just doesn't seem clean.
Is it, if not... If you don't put it in there, does that prevent the board from taking that into consideration or being able to take action?
Yeah,
Yes.
Yeah, so that's something that's mentioned in the universal statute, that where someone can't have a license or certificate revoked, of course, in another state. Otherwise, they would not qualify for the universal license. But, no, yeah, I don't know if that needs to be specified here.
I keep working the language on this.
Hey, Curtin, did you lose the part by a national organization?
Yeah, I was.
I don't see A and B now. It's only A, 1, and 2.
Well, that one's for home inspector.
Oh, that was further up. Okay, my bad. No, sorry.
Oh, but you had this one. Shred down. It satisfies the following, because there's only one thing now.
Yeah.
Don't we handle all of this fingerprint card and disciplinary action and all in the completed application itself? I mean, number one up there, submit a complete application, is going to be necessary regardless of how we do comedy. And wouldn't all of this stuff from D, maybe not C, but D down, wouldn't that be included in that? Submit a complete application? Aren't those the questions we ask in the application itself?
We do ask, but I think D is saying that the board may deny this application if, you know, they have.
Well, under the normal application, the board may deny for that, right?
I would imagine that authority is somewhere within statute or rule itself that kind of gets this. This one's, because this is talking about a specific process for granting registration, that it needs its own. I don't, without knowing exactly all the languages right now, I couldn't tell you.
It just seems like it would be redundant to put it back in here and have to worry about how we word it here if it's being worded someplace else.
Okay, 32. I think currently 32.122.01 says need to be good moral character and repute, but that's going to disappear by the end of this month. That's all been scratched out, and that's where, and then our rules would define that, and that's where our questions come from. We're still waiting on the AG's office to kind of give us an opinion of what that all means, having that scratched out from all the statutes. But, and also the rules are also where we really specify exactly what we want in our applications. And so if this is created, there isn't maybe a specific rule that dictates what needs to be in the application for this. It could be created, but maybe the statute kind of does that for it by specifying it here. Oh, Scott, I know you can't tell us, but I just hate to think that I'm explaining things accurately or not.
I think you're explaining things accurately, Kurt.
Do we need all this in rule in statute if we have the ability to put it in rules? In rules, it's a lot easier to change our mind.
Well, you have to keep in mind that you can't do anything through a rule that is not specifically authorized by statute, and the rules cannot be more expansive or more restrictive than the statutes. So generally speaking, while yes, it is far easier to modify rules than it is to modify statutes, you want to be careful that you don't save something for a rules change and then find that you're unable to actually do it because you don't have the statute in place to specifically authorize you to do that. So something's going to constitute a potential burden to a licensee, such as a requirement that they do X, Y, or Z. You want to have that spelled out in statute rather than waiting for the rules to delineate it, or else you may be prevented from accomplishing that.
Thank you, Scott.
Add storage.
So it being here in statute allows us to probably possibly add that to any kind of rules that clarifies things a bit more about this particular application process.
Yeah, I mean, you could definitely in rule explain what or detail out what you mean substantially equivalent requirements if you wanted to.
At CLEAR last week, there was an individual from a regulatory board in Utah, a really big umbrella, kind of like the boards and commissions here, but with a lot more power over the boards underneath it. And then he explained that instead of using that language, they just use the word similar because their legislatures liked it more. And I was just curious what your thoughts on that was.
Similar instead of what?
Substantially equivalent or greater than. So it would be like that are similar to the requirements of this state.
I like the word similar. It seems more.
I don't know. I like substantially equivalent because it means the contents are similar, not the form or anything else. And I also don't think our legislature is used to substantial equivalent, and it's already throughout our statutes and rules.
It's definitely in the universe.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Okay.
Anything else?
And all the rest of this that was added, if we're going to add fingerprints up here under home inspectors, you have to add it to the fingerprinting language. So I had to add this new statute here and then do all of this. And this is what we did in the other comedy bill in 2019. Mm-hmm. So I looked at that. I looked at the current statutes as they are now, copied them here, and then made the insertions and changes. Mm-hmm. And that's all this is. But if you have any questions, let me know.
And you're checking and double-checking those lines, right?
I'll probably have to check it again at the end of this month.
And having Hayden come up behind you and check it again. Right?
It's going to need to be checked again because after this, all the bills that have gone through, this might be different in a month. And so I'll have to recheck it to see if anything else had been added to the list.
Okay.
But I wanted to make sure that I had it and I don't forget about it. So what I got from this meeting, unless anybody else, anything else they wish to discuss, is for staff is that for the board, we need to add another engineer to the board composition, mm-hmm. scratch out the alarm controlling person, mm-hmm. make sure the home inspector is still included, take that away from the home inspector bill and add it to the definition and comedy bill.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys seem to be okay with the definitions as we have taken them from the model laws of the national councils.
Mm-hmm.
So I can probably move forward with seeing what the national councils and other organizations think of those changes and those definitions.
Mm-hmm.
The exemptions, I need to reach out to ADEQ and the other parties who were in those discussions regarding the exemption of the wastewater treatment facilities to get a better understanding if they even want to change at this time. Get back from them on that. I think you guys are okay with the language of the home inspector bill as is.
Mm-hmm.
And then, do we feel that the comedy language needs to be brought back with any additional changes and narrowing down our ideas from staff?
I don't, but except that Julie was the one who has. We need to know that Julie is satisfied. With the 5 years,
I agree with that. That's the main thing. But I also think there's plenty of additional discussions that will happen before we actually present it. All right, with councils, with
you know, the board. Mm-hmm. So I think some of the things will work themselves out. I'm sure that we'd be available as a committee or individually if you guys need any input.
Very good. And we were able to do that, of course, without getting into a quorum, so, you know, any BCC would occur, and it would not be within an actual discussion of members, but a single staff to single member kind of conversation or question if that were to occur. Scott, is that in line with public meeting law?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Just wanted to make sure. Okay, do you... I know I'm not... I apologize. I'm not a committee member, and I'm not the... should probably be directing things as much as I am right now, but do you want to pick a date for later? Or do you want us to make changes and let you know that we have something from these other organizations prior to trying to set a date?
I think that's probably fine. See where you're at and then notify the, you know, the committee and then set a date after that.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I would do that. I think we're pretty much done with this. I think staff is doing a great job on this, and our opinions are just moving a couple words back and forth here. I don't see that we're going to make many changes.
We will come back. I forgot to mention this in the...
Pardon?
We want to come back with 32.122.01, which is the professional licensure, to come back and look at that. I think we'll also bring something back about that.
Okay.
Presuming that would probably go along with the definitions and penalty bill if any changes were occurred there.
Okay. How long do you need?
It really depends. I mean, before we even got these L&R committees going regarding statutes, board staff has been looking at statute and statutory changes together for probably roughly 6 months. So there's probably already things in there for us to look at, because most of our members here, you know, Julie and Orlean, you know, they're fairly new and everything, but they catch a lot of things that sometimes just don't really make sense or need clarification. Judith, of course, is still fairly new. Even though I've been here for about 6 years, you know, I also have that kind of mentality, well, we've been doing it this way. And, you know, you got to have these new looks at things, and that kind of set up the precedent to start looking at our rules, our statutes, getting ideas, what needs to be looked at. And of course, we're looking at them not as professionals. We're looking at them as, this is kind of complicated or hard for our, you know, stakeholders when they renew, when they apply for their initial registration and things like that. How can it be made easier? And so that's part of the reason that we even started looking at this, because a lot of these statutes and rules the board has are fairly old. It does feel, at least in my opinion, that things are kind of stacked onto each other, because there's no time to really come around and just make a grand, you know, change of everything. It's just you try to pick and choose your battles, and you just insert that little win for that change, and it gets tacked on to something that's, you know, been there forever.
Since 1937.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Kurt.
Yes.
In regards to the disciplinary changes and different things like that, are we looking at anything with the enforcement advisory committees?
In the selection or just the definition of them?
In the past we've talked about, you know, different issues, whether it was consistency or training or different things. I mean, more in the from the surveying side of it, but I don't. Is that really covered anywhere? I guess is what I'm asking.
The statute allows. Is it the statute of the rule, or that allows the creation of EAC and the selection of them? I think statute allows it. The rule specifies the way they do it, but there is no specific training or anything of that nature, or even specifics about what their background needs to be, other than I think they need to be registered and need to show interest, give it to those staff, to the board to consider, and then the board says yea or nay. Without trying to get out of too much of our agenda, I don't know, I don't want to depart from it too much.
I agree, it needs to be looked at.
That could be future, a future L&R committee thing to look at if that needs to be more specified as to do EAC committee members, does the language and statute rule need to specify different qualifications or specify that training is required before or after they become EAC members?
Can we ask staff to research what is written about enforcement advisory and put it on our next L&R committee meeting?
Sure, we can.
Sure, you can.
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
Let's do that.
That comes under future agenda items.
Very good.
I have a feeling that the surveyors and the home inspectors might be more in tune with that type of issue. So, three of us in a room too is not a good thing, and five is definitely not either. So.
We do a lot of enforcement advisory.
So we have talked about future agenda items. Is there anything further on that? In future meetings, we talked about that you'll get some things together and then approach us on a date.
Correct.
And you, we do have definitions coming back. We do have comedy coming back and possibly enforcement advisory. Anything else on the future agenda?
It is just the bills and then any additions or changes that our committee had requested today. Mm-hmm. I'm sure I have that presented for next time. If there's any other statutes, rules, standards, anything like that that you would also wish to discuss, that can always be agendized. And even if you can't think of it right now, you can always contact us so we can, you know, have it added later on.
Right. So with that.
Yeah, where are we on the
agenda? Do I hear a motion?
Future meetings. We're going to have staff tell us. Okay. I make a motion that we adjourn.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Hi, everybody. Thank you. Thank you very much, everybody.
That was fun, gentlemen and ladies. Thank you.